Welcome. You're listening to a podcast by Tohu Magazine, an online art magazine published in three languages, Hebrew, Arabic, and English. Please enjoy this recording, and if you'd like to know more about our magazine, give us a visit at tohumagazine.com.
Hello to all Tohu's listeners and readers. My name is David Ufshani, and today I'm in Jerusalem to speak with Miral Lederman-Yukoles, American artist known for having written the Maintenance Art Manifesto in 1969, and for her performance works that relates to the idea of maintenance.
And Miral, it was also my first question, because I was thinking how to introduce you. You wrote the Maintenance Art Manifesto in 69, also very known the Touch Sanitation Action in 80. And I was thinking of introducing you as a pioneer of performance art, of feminist art, of activist art. And then I was wondering if you feel okay with all these definitions, or if you have
environmental art.
Environmental art.
And then once you say all those things, I really hate all of them, and I'd like you to just say artist.
Okay.
I find it cumbersome, you know, to have that description.
This way I was. I wanted to ask you because
I appreciate that you're trying to find some way to.
I didn't talk because also I have the same feeling, and I think many artists share this this feeling towards definitions.
Right.
So
like you don't anyways, want to get locked into a
all of us
who
all those who will listen to the podcast will find also a link to the manifesto, to the Maintenance Arts Manifesto, and some other documentations.
Wonderful.
For those ones. So I won't repeat the historical material. And so my second question was about the ways you conceive the signature, or the artist signature, which is something which is a bit in debate these recent years, because you've written the Maintenance Art Manifesto, and it's a manifesto, but it's also a work of art.
Right.
And then you do actions, which are actions by themselves, but they also in a way illustrate or follow up the manifesto. And I was wondering if you had a special thought about the way you define, or the way you act between the manifesto, between the actions, and the way you work with people. Are the people you work with are only actors, or I mean, if I would be a bit silly, could I make maintenance art, or
yeah. You can do whatever you want to. You could certainly make maintenance art. I've actually thought a lot about these things. For example, I made a rubber stamp, I think in 1970-something, that says Maintenance Artworks Original, mm-hmm. and it has, and my name. And it has a blank space for the date, which I would put in. But, and when I, for example, I did a performance work at the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum, where I took a vitrine in which there was a 2,000-year-old mummy. And I did a performance work with me, the artist, the maintenance worker who, that was his job to mm-hmm. clean the vitrine. He's not ever allowed to touch the art. His job is to clean the protective structures that signify this is a treasured object, or this has value. Like it's mm-hmm. like a quotation marks for, or a little sound like, ta-da, this is art. Inside, but he can't touch the art. Mm-hmm. But he was expert at cleaning all the glass cases and shelves in the museum. And the third person was the conservator. And the job of the conservator is to touch the art. If the art needs to be cleaned, the conservator is the only person that can put his or her hands on the artwork. So this is what happened. I invited the maintenance worker to do his regular job, which was to clean the vitrine. Then I came along and I took his tools, which were a diaper. That's what the museum used, a cloth diaper. You know what that is? It's like a cloth thing that you put on babies, like Huggies.
This is what he used.
Pampers. That's what the doc. You know what that is?
Yes.
That's what this museum, many museums use diapers to clean.
I didn't know that.
They're very soft and they don't have very much lint. So he gave me Windex, a glass cleaner, and a diaper. That's what he had just used. Mm-hmm. And I copied him. I said, I am making a dust painting on this glass structure. I copied his movements because he knows how to do this job the best. And when I finished, I stamped it with my maintenance art stamp that says original, even though it's a rubber stamp. So there's an irony immediately because maintenance tasks are always repeated. There's never one original maintenance, where there maybe 1,000 years ago was an original cleaning act. Mm-hmm. That was the original, but maintenance is always repeating itself forever and ever. You finish, then you have to do it again, start again.
Yes.
I stamped it. As soon as I stamped it, this man who was the expert could no longer touch the vitrine.
Because
he literally couldn't touch it.
It became a work of art.
It became a work of art because I said so. Then the conservator came. He had a whole prepared list of checking off a condition report. It's called a condition report. He filled it out, decided that the artwork was dirty and it needed cleaning.
Okay.
And so I handed him the diaper and the Windex, and he copied the first guy. And we took a photograph before of us three and a photograph after.
How long was the action?
I don't remember. Maybe an hour, the whole thing, I think. And the same photo with the same people, the same photograph, only before he had a kind of power. At the end, he had none. It had, so that I can understand why the museum needs to have this system of saying, this you can touch, this you can't touch, but there's a human element that gets kind of, I don't know, questionable. Like the guy who knows the most was X'd out of the picture, actually.
Okay.
So that signing, and I've signed many works like that, that look signed but are rubber stamps that are inherently repetitive. Because the work that I deal, that I'm interested in dealing with, is always repetitive. So the question is about originality. Which I want to raise up and make palpable. Now, there was a performance work that had a great influence on me, and that was, I was washing the sidewalk in 1974 in front of the old AIR gallery. That was the first feminist art gallery in New York City. I was in a show inside. I washed the sidewalk. I taped off the area, and I announced that I'm responsible. I'm turning this into an artwork. I'm maintaining this as art from 2 o'clock till 5 o'clock, and I proceeded to wash the. It was filth. It was Soho in '74, which was very, very dirty, still sort of industrial, and I was running out of rags. Like I had brought rags that I had saved up from my house. Mm-hmm. And I brought them, and that's what I was washing with, or brush, or mostly rags. they were just disintegrating right in front of my eyes. And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? I have several hours to go. How am I going to keep working? All of a sudden, a superintendent, like a guy who takes care of the building, like Shmulek,
okay,
at school,
yes,
walks across the street. It's very noisy, still quite a few factories in Soho. It's beginning to like shift, galleries, people, but still in heavy industry, manufacturing. This guy walked across the street carrying a big load of rags, industrial rags. He walked right into the area that I had taped off to be the art space, and he said, here. That's all he said. Here. And he gave me this gift. He didn't say, why is this art? What makes this art? This is silly. He saw that I needed, and he gave like that. I was so moved by this guy that I started wrapping the rags around me, like to incorporate his gift right into my body. And I changed my name to Mop Foot. Like I became a cleaning machine because of him. And I was able to keep working. We had no conversation. I felt that he got it. Like the art spoke to him without me explaining it. And that he saw that I needed it, and he gave it to me. From that, so that had a very strong influence on me, that others could be part of the work. And I think from that point on, I made my work with other people. See, up until that point, when I did the mummy thing, mm-hmm. so I needed the maintenance worker and and I would work with, say, one person, a worker, a few people like that. But after that, then I sort of, my work scaled up to, then I did a big piece with 300 workers, like all the workers in a skyscraper. Then from there to the sanitation department, all the workers in 8,500, like that. That I felt that it was possible. And really the feeling that, a calm feeling that I had, that it was possible, came because of that man. That superintendent. That we shared, you have the work, you have to do the work. To do the work, you need some rags. Here.
Okay.
That's it.
So how do you deal differently when you have to make not an action or a work itself, but a presentation of the work, so an exhibition? You have had a big show in the Queen's Museum recently, and right. I imagine that along your career you also had to show your work. I know you're working right. with a gallery.
Right.
So,
okay, so
how does that feel comparing?
It's a really big subject. It's a big subject because I show it like in the Queen's Museum. So I was dealing with 50 years of work, right? So what am I going to show? Am I going to keep washing the floor for however many, it's like several months of the show? No, I wasn't. I have many works that are are photographs of performance works. And that's not all of my work, but mm-hmm. in terms of dealing with the performance works, I have, luckily, the people who invited me, like the AIR Gallery, they got me a photographer. Or the Wadsworth Athenaeum got me, in 15 different places. I said, I need a photographer. They got a photographer. This was like the 70s. I had very strong rule that I do my work. I set up the performance work. I do the performance work. but I don't direct the photographer. The photographer does their work, I do my work.
When you say this was the rule, it means that then...
It was my rule.
Your rule, okay.
I felt that it would contaminate the performance work. If I do what I do, if people enter the performance, they do what they do. It's a preserving people's freedom. Like, I didn't tell the photographer what to do.
Was that different from other performances that were taking part in that time?
During that time? I don't know.
Were you thinking about it? Or?
I was feeling that was the way you have to do a performance work. Did I really go check other people's performance works? I don't even know. Where did I get that idea that I couldn't tell the photographer what to do? I have very strong feeling about it. Now, and this was like such an early time in performance art. At the end of the performance, the photographer took the negatives, the film, and gave them to me. I don't even know the names of a lot of these. But I feel so bad. I would love to write their name down. That now people have said, so then I, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years later, I want to show you what I did. So I show you these photographs, which I have selected and I present in a certain way.
So
I call them artworks. Now, there's a discussion in the art world about that this is not artworks, this is documentation. But, so I say it is documentation, but it's also artwork. It's an artwork because I've selected among the 1,000 images, 15 images, to speak to you about the performance. But it is an issue. It's an issue that should be discussed.
It's the same discussion, I guess, about the maintenance
art
manifesto as well. It's the manifesto work of art or a manifesto.
Oh, no. There's no discussion about that.
No.
I made a manifesto, and that's an artwork. There's no...
Okay.
Karl Marx made a manifesto in 1848. So is his a work of art? No. His was a political proposal. Fluxus made manifestos. The futurists made manifestos. Those were works of art also. I think what you're asking is, or maybe you are, then the works that come out of the manifesto, are they artworks? Are they use the word illustration, which makes me hysterical?
It's not the correct term. My English is not accurate. But I think one of the things that I find interesting in your work and that I can relate to also personally is this kind of going on or passing through mediums or ways of seeing what a work of art is. And this is actually I don't think there's a correct answer, but the way you raise these questions is something that I find interesting. I also know that you're...
Interested in that.
And also...
Especially in the 70s. From when I went to art school, there was the painting, sculpt, you know, art is much deeper than all of that.
Of course.
And the question of what is the art, you know, what can be the art, those are issues that need to always, always be questioned, interrogated. Mm-hmm. Now, you did say something that I find very interesting, and that is that I wrote this manifesto out of a sense of great desperation, that I felt, I don't know how to do, you know, that all the things I've been to a lot of art school, and that what I was taught wasn't helping me with my current life, being a mother, being an artist, how do you put this together? I was lost. I felt absolutely lost. And many, many women in that situation give up. I know that.
Yes.
Not so much anymore.
Still,
but even now.
Maybe less, but still, it's still an issue.
It's still an issue. It's still an issue. But then a lot of people, they would never talk about being a mother or having children. They wouldn't even talk about it. I learned many years later about women artists that had children. I never even knew that. So I wrote this manifesto out of my own desperation to keep going as an artist. That's really what I did. And that I suddenly had this understanding was like, boom, like a shift. It was a mental shift that, I define art, period. And it doesn't matter how it was defined 1,000 years before. That's not how it really works. How it works is the artist says, this is the art, for whatever reason. That's how art works, like that. You have full responsibility and you have full freedom to do that. That's what being an artist is about. Okay, now what you said, which is interesting, is, so I wrote this manifesto, it's 3.5 pages. And it seems like a lot of work ever after, since 1969, that's 50 years ago, rolled out of that.
Articulates.
What is it? Does it develop? Does it manifest? Does it reveal?
It's something that I find natural. I don't say it is something negative.
No, but it's kind of weird.
And also,
it's kind of weird, but it's true.
I don't know if you've seen the manifesto exhibition. And there's also an excerpt of your manifesto in one of the films.
Yes.
And one of the funny things in every manifesto is that they always come before the work. It's something that is usually done as an exclamation of the future. So I think it's very natural that the work follows.
It opens the door. It does.
Before the things happen.
And usually it comes out of great feeling of desperation, and then you break the door open. It's not such a quiet, peaceful act. It's the hell with everything.
Yes.
I need this, and that's what it. And that's the deal. Bang. That's the matter. Now the question of the works. I noticed, like in this, the manifesto is also has this sort of conceptual base of ideas that I needed to have to almost like say that this is how this shift is happening. What was, and now what I'm saying is. But it also was a proposal for an exhibition. And the exhibition, which I really had an image that I would take over the whole Whitney Museum, the old one, not the new one.
This was the CARE exhibition.
CARE. The Breuer, what's called now the Met Breuer building. What I needed the whole museum because I needed to change everything, like to start all over again. And it came, the proposal was in a triad, like a three-part thing, personal, society, and planetary, like the Earth. And that was actually very natural for me. Many people have talked about my work that it's like domestic, you know, making it okay for domestic tasks to be considered art. But actually that was about that, but it was always, from the very, very beginning, as much about society, as much about the Earth, as it was about domestic. And I actually see these things as flowing one into the other. That maintenance deals with all three at the same time. And that if you're going to rethink this whole thing and rethink what can be thought of as culture in Western society, which never thought about maintenance and didn't give a voice to maintenance work or maintenance workers. I mean, P.S., here we are with the world not cared for.
Yes, so it's actually very relevant for today's discussion.
Guess what?
Even more, maybe, than
right.
when you did it.
Guess what? Guess what? You don't take care, and guess what? And as boring as it is, and it's boring. It's boring. I used to feel like my head was going to explode. You know, if I love my children, but changing a diaper 1,000 times, I really felt like my brain was going to say goodbye. Goodbye. That's not what I'm made for. I'm made to create new things, right? It is important, but if you don't do this stuff, things fall apart. They fall apart. It is. But I want to go back to this notion of care. Care runs through personal, societal, and the earth itself, like as our home. It's actually kind of a notion of care about a home. And the home has this scale, has this scale, has the whole.
It's all related.
It is related. That kind of thinking, whole thinking, that's not Western education. So that's a big fat problem. And that's why this work is still relevant to this day, because the greatness of Western culture and education isn't going to get us all the way to making a world for all the people in the world. It's not, the ideas aren't enough, except for the idea of freedom. That's enough for everybody. But then you have to deal with the people that don't, you know, that have different ideas.
So, and I guess that's something that also comes in mind when you go and see young people today, or when you see the younger generation that as a teacher.
You know, I have done visiting artists lectures and studio visits for many, many years, but I never, I did one, but I don't stick around. It's like a one-shot thing. Like I'll come, give a lecture, meet a few students, and leave. It'd be 2 days. The Bezalel thing, I was a senior critic at Yale for a year. And I went once a month. So that was a little bit like this. But the Bezalel thing, coming every week and seeing students, getting a chance to watch the development of a student over 2 years, that's a new thing for me. And they're free to do what they want. But I enjoy very much listening. And also, look, we moved here 6 years ago. Basically, I feel like I don't understand what the hell's going on here.
Yes, this was also something I wanted to talk to you about, the move, and not only the reasons for the move, but the ways your interaction with the Israeli... I don't know if culture is the correct word, but... sure is a lot of maintenance to do here, and especially in Jerusalem, I guess.
I say to myself, how long is it going to take before people think I'm an Israeli artist? And Jack says, I don't know if they're ever going to.
I don't think that's the direction.
Huh?
I don't think that's the way.
What do I have to do to be an Israeli artist?
Do you want
artist?
To be an Israeli artist? Consider an Israeli
well,
artist.
I don't, that again, it's a kind of definition. Do I want to have a modifier for artists?
Are you working on something?
Here I am living here. I'm living here. So am I an Israeli? Am I an Israeli artist? I don't know. One of my kids has lived here for 25 years, and she still feels like she's sort of an Israeli, but people don't think of her as an Israeli. And I ask a lot of people, they say, if you're born here, then you're an Israeli. Do you feel like you're an Israeli?
For me, yes, for good and for worse, because I was born
here.
You
were born here. Are members of your family, you think of them as being Israeli?
Yes, I think.
Were they born here also?
Yes, in my case,
yes. Oh, your family, they were all born, everybody was born here?
Yes. So in a way, for me, it wasn't an issue because it's the family is here for a long time.
Huh.
So, but are you also working on something here, or is it just the place you live? I know you often go, you often travel. Every time I meet you, you say, I'm going to give a lecture here
and
there.
I actually have, like what you're surrounded by here is bits and pieces from there that came here. We don't have time to deal with them. Here they are sitting around. For many years already. Now, the fact is that I'm still doing work in the United States, and I go back and forth, and most of the art that I'm doing now is still not here. And I hope I'll be able to live long enough to actually do work here.
Do you have a direction or a thought of something?
Of what I would do here?
What would you do here?
No.
Not yet?
No. I feel like I'm sort of learning, listening, upset.
Upset.
I'm upset. A lot. I'm very worried about what's going to happen. How is this country going to work it out? You know, like my daughter's the curator of Islam and the Middle East in the National Library, and she's an Islam scholar, and she's trying to create educational programming and cultural programming, to make a space in the National Library for Arabic culture, for Palestinian culture. Because right now, and she's made some progress, but it's like always a continuing struggle. Now, 20% of the population of Israel is not Jewish. And yet the presence of Palestinian culture, or I see the students at Bezalel, what complicated situation they're in as artists. I think they're in very complicated situation. And they're Israeli, Palestinian, Arab artists, right? They're not from outside. There could be many Palestinian artists that aren't Israeli, don't happen to be in a school. It's really complicated. It's about hopefulness. So I'm upset. There's not so much hopefulness. I think there's a lot of people are just stop thinking about things. They focus on what they can focus on, but they're not thinking they can affect big things.
I think you can see it a lot coming to Jerusalem. For me, every time I come here, you can really feel the daily struggle. And
you think you feel that more here?
Now on the way, I think about it every time I come to Jerusalem, and I was thinking, I came where I took the train and then I took the bus, and I was thinking about you taking this road every time you go to the airport or every time you go to Tel Aviv to lecture. Right. And every time you go to the central station or to the bus station or after the bus or the train station, you can see all these families with their children. And I saw this mother with seven or six or seven children, and And the bus came and she shouted, everybody come, come, the bus is here. And she had a small lunch box with brownies. And she opened and they all ate like a small piece of chocolate. And it's kind of this, I said, she was thinking about it. She woke up early and she prepared it. She planned it. And this was like a small moment of, and specifically with food, it's like a moment of pleasure and of like a like a small escape from the hard world. And I think you can feel it more in Jerusalem. Tel Aviv is usually considered to be more of a, like a makeup city. Things are high. And I'm asking myself if you knew it or if you chose to be in Jerusalem also in a way of seeing reality, which is more, you cannot escape the reality in Jerusalem.
We moved here because my kids, two of my kids lived here. My brother lived here. My sister-in-law lived here. It was more a family thing. It wasn't all that intellectual, thought-out thing. I do think that in when you live in Jerusalem, you see more Palestinians than you see in Tel Aviv.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes. You barely see
except at the beach, you see.
From once in a while.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you can live in Tel Aviv and, you know, it's sort of like New York. I mean, like, it's like so urban. It's lovely, except for the whole thing with the people from Africa have such a hard time.
Yes. Well, in a way, it's like a pyramid that is sustained upon all the rest of this of the country. So Tel Aviv is like on the shoulders of all the rest. It's maintained in a way.
Look, I'm upset about Israel. I'm upset about America. Terribly upset about America. First of all, I see so many Israelis, they like President Trump.
Yes, yeah, it's an issue.
They like him. I hate him. I mean, my God, I can't believe it. I can't believe what's happening in America. There are children locked up in these detention centers. I read a story today, a kid who's 14. The older children are taking, they're no adults. They sleep on the concrete floor. This is in America. Yes. The older children are taking care of the younger children. The children, a lot of them are ill. This kid who's 14 said to a reporter, I'm just a kid. I need somebody to take care of me. I'm taking care of all these children. They're just locked up in these camps. So, and what's shocking to me is that the people that voted for Trump and that support Trump, actually, I got all the way through school, through college. I didn't pay attention to people like that. I didn't see them. I really actually, I was shocked when he won. I thought he couldn't win. That such a person couldn't win. But it's not just him. There are lots of people who really love him. He could do any stupid thing that he, horrible, terrible thing that he does. They love him. I didn't see those people.
Well, they were in the backstage.
Me, you know, I'm like talking about, I see people that are invisible, right? Like all these workers that do this maintenance work that nobody pays attention to. Me, I didn't see those people that elected this guy lunatic to be president. You know, I'm afraid, I'm going to say lunatic, and they're going to come after me.
No, don't worry. But this will shift the conversation more political, but I think there's a lot of studies on the the political views of the working class, not only in America but also in Europe, the way things like the left kind of fell completely apart, and the right wing extremist took everything.
Look at let me tell you something. I just read an article that about my own work that I find it very hard to read these articles that people write about my work. So I finally read this article that was written a few years ago. And she said it's very nice that she went around shaking the hands of all these sanitation workers and all that, but she didn't go far enough. She should have organized them, thousands of people. She should have organized them for to improve their job quality or something like that. As if I could have.
Well, I think it's a problematic proposition because it's not there to patronize them or.
And they have a very strong labor unions.
They know
how to organize, yes. And they have very strong labor unions.
This was actually I've recently had a talk by Noam Chomsky about the intellectuals of the 30s and the 20s, and the way it was very popular for them to go and. As this article says, like try and organize the workers, and in a way, one of the failures of the left today is the retreat and the staying in places like Tel Aviv or like New York and inside this bubble and not going
and deal with workers.
Not deal with workers like
who are probably pretty right wing themselves.
Yes.
See what the trouble, like a lot of sanitation workers voted for Trump, a lot of them. So then I get shocked.
Did you have conversations with those people after the elections?
No.
In recent
not
activities? No. Could be interesting to
shocked.
To see.
Like the labor union movement, well, you say the left sort of has fallen apart. Why? It's so hard, even in Israel especially, it's so hard to understand why there's so little power on the left. Why don't people want to be part of that more progressive agenda? Why? I don't understand it. But it's happening in the United States and Europe. They're all over the place. I thought we were over that. I thought it was going to keep getting better and better on us. Things would get better and better for more and more and more people.
Yes, it seems
and they don't see it that way. People don't see it that way. So I think it's a very confusing time now. And people like me, who like to think of myself as being very progressive, didn't see a lot of... I'm not listening hard enough.
So you're kind of questioning yourself or your...
Yeah. Somebody better question something or other. Mm-hmm. The people in Israel on the left don't seem to have supporters.
No. Well, they do, but the supporters come from the elite of society and not from
people.
From
workers.
The workers, as you say.
Why?
It's a good question to ask ourselves. Anyways, I'm curious to see if a new work that you will do here.
Okay, so David, let me tell you a few things, what I'm doing. I'm in a show in Chicago at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. I'm actually, because I'm here and they're there, and we have a very little, small budget, the school got a filmmaker who just graduated, like you just graduated, Julian Flavin. And we are concocting a video long distance together. You actually work with people long distance.
Yes.
In Paris, right?
Yes.
So he's doing research about Chicago, and eventually we're going to make a video together. He's going to start the video, and then I'm going to come there in August and really make it fast and edit it fast. And I'm not such a fast worker, but that's what we're going to do. We're just going to do it. I hope to God it'll be okay. It will be about sanitation workers. But I'm just learning things.
Okay.
And it's going to be in a show. It could be a disaster, but I think it'll be okay. He's very good. He's very bright. He's very curious. He's doing a hell of a lot of research.
And so it's really a collaboration.
Yes, it is going to
it's
be
not
a collab-
like in previous
no,
words.
No, that's fine. It's fine. It's going to be a collaboration with him, because he's from there, and I sort of like the whole idea.
Did you reach him, or was it
no?
The
they
other
found
way,
the curators. The curators. One of the curators teaches film, and I he invited me to come speak in his class, and I met his very big class of filmmakers, and I had no idea what to do, and I said, where did you go to elementary school? So they all cracked up, and it gave people a chance to talk about not just elementary school, but all sorts of things that nobody ever asked them before. And I remember him from that class, and he said he would like to work with me. So we're going to do something. We're going to do something. I'll let you know in October. If it was a disaster or not.
When's the opening schedule?
September 20th.
Thank you for listening to this podcast by Tohu Magazine. To discover more textual and visual content published by Tohu in Hebrew, Arabic, and English, please go to tohumagazine.com.